This is John McGuire, and you are listening to Always Record, episode 165, The Act of Killing. Watched the movie in its entirety?
Yeah, I watched the movie. I waited too late in the night to watch it, so there came towards the... I think the movie's just kind of emotionally exhausting anyway.
Yes.
But, like, towards the end of the movie, I was just like, oh my god. Like, I'm so done.
I mean, I made you watch the director's cut. That's an extra 40 minutes of that.
Oh no, it was fantastic. Really, it was really, really fantastic. Thank you for recommending it. Before we go too far off the deep end here, can you kind of give listeners what are we talking about here? What's the movie? How'd you sell it to me, and what's it about?
Okay, so the movie's called The Act of Killing, and it came out probably a few years ago now, or a little bit more. But regardless, it's directed by Josh Oppenheimer. Josh Oppenheimer was originally a physicist, or at least went to school for physics, and then transitioned into filmmaking, which is quite a transition. But honestly, considering the way that a lot of us think in this community, it's not such a stretch. So anyway, he became a filmmaker, and he was politically active and decided to document the union struggles of farm workers in Indonesia, who basically, the unions and everything, people, power-related in that country, had been destroyed in the 1960s in a pseudo-conflict, a geopolitical pseudo-conflict between communists and, you know, Democracy Incorporated. And Democracy Incorporated paid the military junta of Indonesia to basically eliminate all the leftists, and they killed millions of people. I mean, in the most horrific... It is the darkest stuff. All for money and power and all those base things, and it was all based on lies. And so these people, these laborers are basically slave labor now. I mean, it's not even like here. It's not even, I mean, obviously I don't have to say this. It's obvious, but it's, I mean, they're slaves. They're not just like people without unions necessarily. They have all sorts of problems, but a union is a big step. So he went through to document that. And got into the story of the genocide. The people were talking about their situation to him. It's like, we still live under the children and the people who committed the genocide. But I mean, it's a different time. The genocide isn't happening now. There's like a sham democracy in place. So people, in a sense, like the military junta has to behave itself for PR purposes and so on. But people are still horribly afraid. And afraid, always threatened that, oh, it could happen again tomorrow if you bring it up. Don't fucking bring it up. Keep it inside. Don't bring it up. And he, Josh Oppenheimer, I think in one of his interviews, he says this a lot, but because I've watched like all his interviews. So, and I imagine if anyone listens to us enough, they hear us say the same things over and over again. But he often says it was like possibly being in Nazi Germany after the Nazis had won and everyone had to acclimate themselves to the idea that people had been put in ovens and like people had been stolen from their lives and everyone had to just pretend that everyone was just neighbors and it was fine because otherwise you'd get killed. And so these people have been suffering this silence, this like imposed silence and this imposed fear this kingdom of fear. And the movie is a deep exploration of that. And what happens is, like, Josh Oppenheimer managed to start meeting perpetrators, because the perpetrators are still, like, local thugs or politicians or whatever. I mean, they were all thugs and they're all criminals and they're all murderers, but they all moved into different directions after the genocide. That was their reward. So he started low in the lower tier thugs and kept working up into other folks. And he found that they trusted him because he was just American. And of course, I mean, I don't know. I don't want to call it naivete. It's like, cause that's dismissive, because like we're so fucking media cynical and quote unquote savvy here, that we call other people naive. But the truth is, like, the people that have committed these murders have, like, subscribed to the idea that all Americans support what they were doing and continue to support what they're doing and don't question, oh, this might be a liberal in our midst who might not agree with us. Cause he wasn't going in there and judging them or asking them. He was just saying, hey, tell me about all the people you killed, please. And they were happy to do it, seemingly, gleefully. Which is what's so disturbing about the movie, is that a lot of it is people recounting the killings of how they did it, how many they did it, like, and so on. And so he got this taste of it. Like, people kept wanting to show him what they did, and he couldn't understand. He was just, like, blown away, because, A, aren't these people afraid that, you know, this could be used as evidence against them at some point, and B, it's like, really, are they this monstrous? Like, so he was like, well, what is inspiring this behavior? Like, why are they boasting about it? It makes no sense to me. And as he went on, he discovered, like, the deep guilt that all these men continue to feel. And the movie really documents, like, it focuses on a select group of the higher level people that he eventually came into contact with, a circle of, like, 4 to 5 people, and then satellite folks who are come in and out of the movie that you get familiar with. But the story really focuses around even one person in particular named Anwar Kongo, who was the ultimate executioner, so to speak, in his day. And the old man he is now, it's like, it's deceptive, because he doesn't come off that way. He's just like this really slow-moving, methodical, actually very open person about, like, being alive and, like, how he feels about his nightmares and, like, the things he's done. He talks openly. It's strange. It's very childlike and also very dark, but illuminating to see how people deal with their pain. So the movie goes on, and it's them and he convinces them to reenact their murders for film. Not actually like snuff films, but it's just like they're acting in their own films. They don't bring in any of the any families of victims. They don't bring any past victims. The filmmaker was very conscious of, like, post-traumatic stress and people reliving their traumas, and so he wanted to make sure it stayed focused on the perpetrators and that they were doing it themselves and they were focusing on themselves. So they would take on the role of their own victims and relive, like, these events where now the roles are reversed. And it's just, it's amazing to watch, because you see how they're just, like, what they're working through in those moments. And it's just, it's an illuminating side of, like, what it means to just not be able to let stuff go in your life. Well, not even just, like, what you do and then not taking ownership of it or not allowing any healing to take place. And it's an exploration of what happens when men just rot out from the inside and 30 years later. And, like, it's a lot of that. It's a lot of the worst of broken humans. But it's like, it sounds so dark, but for me, it was like, there's a strange compassion to it all. And, like, an actual powerful healing element to it, because the film in Indonesia is a huge success, a huge fucking success. It went through all kinds of trouble of getting, like, film. No one in the credits can be even given credit to that helped Josh in Indonesia, because he'd be fucking hunted down. So it's like, it looks like Josh did everything, but you look at the credits, it's like anonymous, and it's just all, it's incredible, incredible effort. And so it was like an Indonesian effort. It wasn't just some American, it was Indonesians realizing they, like, needed to do something to initiate the healing process, and they motivated him to do it, because in their wisdom they realized that talking about this, there has to be a conversation again. We just can't keep ignoring that this shit happened, because we're still neighbors. What the fuck are we doing? We're, like, in a community. I know your father killed my father, and we, like, have to smile at each other on the street. It's like, we're already living that life, so why don't we just talk about it and get it out in the open. Like, I don't want to keep blaming you. You don't want to, like, feel guilty about wronging me. This is really what's going on in people's heads, but they, like, subscribe to the narratives that they were beckoning us and we were the good guys and it was black and white and I can keep going on that way. And so in Indonesia, like, it started out small, getting independent screenings and people just like spreading it through word of mouth. And now it's played in large theaters and like it's a national conversation about what's going on and like the idea of what are we doing about this as a country? That's incredible. And that's like the power of film. It shows the power of film for bringing about healing. And it's not like the men in this movie like find peace or anything. But it shows you, like, why are people so interested in film, like, the power of film. And it reminded me of, like, work that synchronicity people do with film and use it as something. It's like, no, I don't always get it, and it's not always my thing, but it's, like, it's a powerful medium for exploring the self. And this is one of the most powerful movies I've ever seen for exploring the self. It's so, so human and, like, so universal, even though it's like, how could I ever find myself relating to a fucking person that's committed genocide, but I mean, it's the things, the truthiness that comes out of their mouths. It's like, wow. And some of them are more cynical and straightforward. Others are still hiding from it in certain ways. As you're a first time viewer, you can tell me what hit you most about it.
Oh yeah. So it was just really impactful, throughout. I mean, I feel like, as you say, the power of film is interesting to see, not just the, you know, them saying, and I don't mean this like, Western movies made them evil, but like, as you said, there's almost like the influence where they talk about, in, you know, old Western movies, they killed people like this. So then that's how we decided to do it. And, you know, they were fans of Western cinema. So, in the mob movies, they did it like this. So we tried that out, you know. So there is this sort of, and again, I'm not blaming, let's blame, you know, Western, military industrial complex powers for directly influencing their actions in a much more direct way.
Yeah, I mean, that created the circumstance. We can always, right, like, you know, doesn't happen all the time still. It's like, the poor children are being exposed to this horrible media and they're becoming monsters. And it's just like, dude.
Yeah, I just want to say, I'm not trying to make that
no,
point,
I know you're
but
not.
to say like there's the sort of violent influence there. But then to kind of, as you say, turn it around on itself. So throughout the film, having the perpetrators of this genocide, they're doing a bunch of, it's basically like they tell, it seems like they think they're making a different movie.
Yeah.
Right. They're not making this documentary. They're making what it sounds like it would have been a series of vignettes as it was pitched, because there are points where they're talking about a chronology and they're saying, this is, you know, it's a series of stories. It's a collection of stories. So I imagine they're doing these sort of unrelated scenes in their mind. So there's scenes where they are recommitting their crimes. And then there's also scenes where they are the victims of the crimes. And then in those moments, in that role reversal, you know, it's like some sort of weird S&M skit where suddenly, you know, the gimp is fucking you in the ass and it's like, whoa, what is this? You see them sort of like, wow, I don't like this, you know? So in that same way, seeing this sort of Western cinema in whatever way influencing some of the crimes themselves, but then also using that same medium to turn it around, just like in some of the scenes where they're turning it around. That to me, that juxtaposition is really fascinating. I want to ask a question before I forget. You keep saying American, that he was trusted as an American, but in the film they keep saying he's from London. Is that a cover? Do you know, is that like, was that his cover story or is that just a?
That's a good question. Oh, you know what? Because he's lived in London. And I'm sure, like, as he's gotten to know these men, like, he did get to know them personally to some degree. So I'm sure it came up like, yeah, I'm from America, but I'm in London right now. he wasn't telling them, hey, this is my address, but he was never afraid to like sort of talk openly that way with them, because it was sort of a, there had to be some amount of trust or some amount of honesty to allow him to stay there, because they would see through it if not. So I'm pretty sure that's where that came from when they brought it up. But it could have very well be a total cover story. But I've seen an interview of him where he was in London, so I have reason to believe he either has held space there for a time, continues to, or splits time there. Who knows, you know?
Gotcha. Okay. It was just a question.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you see, like, as far as them catching on to him, there are moments where it seems like you could see some people are looking at him more suspiciously than others.
Yeah.
And there's the one guy who he's like, oh, you're going to try and turn this around that I'm a villain? You know, you're going to try and, you know, you want to submit me to the Geneva Convention? You know.
That was, his name is Adi. And Adi comes in like, I don't know, halfway through the movie, or a little earlier, but he is like, he's the most upfront sociopath of all of them, because he's clearly a sociopath. Not all of them are, I would say. I would say a lot of them, like Anwar, for example, the main character, if we want to call him that, I don't sense him as a sociopath. I sense he's someone that sold his soul and done unspeakable things, and you see that he's broken by it. In his physical stature and the way, oh god, the retching, but we'll get into that. And then here comes Adi, who comes off a plane with this cynical, ridiculous t-shirt on. I'm forgetting what it said, but it's just like, I don't know.
It's apathy.
Apathy. It's like, it says it all about him. He's like, I've totally, like, I don't care. He's talking about, like, stabbing his girlfriend's father at the time because he suddenly had permission to. Because he could just say he was a communist, and he did it because he didn't like the guy. I mean, this is like the space that was created for these people, for certain people like him. And then there were others like Anwar who had to be incentivized because they were just really doing it for the money and the power and like feeling good about themselves because they were insecure, small people. They weren't necessarily sociopaths. They were sucked into this sort of spiral of death and destruction. Whereas someone like Adi, who is, so, I mean, insane, like, wow. Like he'd seen through what's going on, but he also wasn't afraid of it.
Yeah, he saw
it and he knew what was going on, but he never said, stop this film. This is like nothing that can be said. He said openly, when we put this film out, okay, so we're going to finish this film and people are going to know that we were liars. Because we were liars. He says it to everyone like in the room and they're all like, mm-hmm, yeah. And there's no real disagreement. He's like, people are going to know that the communists weren't the evil ones. We were the evil ones. It's just, it's amazing. Like, he's just like, yeah, I'll be upfront about it. I'm a fucking criminal, but I make the rules now, so tough shit.
Yeah.
And I can make this movie about the people I've killed. At the same time, he's aware that it's dangerous, that it's like dangerous to put these ideas out again, because it would start a national conversation, and it has. Like, the things he was afraid of, they are happening. And that's like what the power of this movie is and was meant to be. But it's amazing to just see it recognized by the people in it, talked about right in front of you, and then they just keep going on with it. And like at the end of the conversation, he's like, I'm uncomfortable with this. It's going to expose us as liars, but that's all I'm going to say. And then they just keep going with it. You know, like turn on the director, you know, it's just like, yes, there's those moments of tension. And he said that in his time there, he always had an escape car set up. He knew that that was a potential where they would get really uncomfortable and they might just snap on him. Because he pushes them too far or they just feel uncomfortable, you know? So he had to, like, be very aware of what was going on and, like, the environment that was ebbing and flowing. It was really
dangerous. There's another scene where when they're recreating the, like, burning village.
Yep.
And that one, I think he's, like, the vice president of something, comes... I don't remember he wasn't like the vice president of the country, but
he's the head of the paramilitary, which is like, he was at least strongly affiliated.
Oh, maybe he was right. Maybe he was the vice president of that paramilitary group or something. Anyway, whatever it was. During that scene, they have one of the uppity ups come to this, as they're filming this scene. And, after they do the first take, of all the men screaming and being, you know, their bloodlust and all this sort of stuff. He's like, oh, I don't like this. This makes us look like savage, bloodthirsty maniacs. This is not good for our image. We shouldn't use this. He's like, is there a way to film this where we come off looking nicer? Like, he's like, is there a way to be like, gently, like, we have to kill these people, you know?
Yeah.
Cause they're right, cause he can't change the history of it. So he understands they're creating a historical recreation. So you can't change the events that are about to happen. They're going to come and kill all these people. But he's like, can we do it maybe that we don't look as, you know, as savage, or bloodthirsty? He's like, what makes us look very bad? And then there seemed to be, I watched the director's cut, so you get that extra time, but it seems like there's some sort of conversation that's happening in there, because he says that there's like a very tiny back and forth, and then it sort of jumps forward, and he's saying, okay, leave it. Maybe it is good for us, because then it makes us look like, it helps our image of being intimidating. We might not look, it might not be good PR, but it's good, it's good to scare people, yeah. You know? And, I thought that was interesting, and I'm sort of curious what would have sort of happened in those moments. But then you notice he leaves, because he goes, I don't like having my face in the middle of this scene where this looks this bad. And then he leaves before the fucking, actual torture and burning of the village happens.
Yeah. In my understanding of it, like, he was intimidated into saying those things. The director said he got the sense that he said that there was a sense of unease at him saying that in the crowd, and definitely amongst like the other higher ups that were there.
Mm.
There was like a small conference and like sort of a back and forth that was talked about. It. No, we want to scare people into just like, cause we don't want them thinking that it won't happen again, because a lot of them aren't committed to genocide again. In a way they are, but you can see it's like they don't. No one wants that again. It's like everyone's so exhausted in this film by the lies. And like the upkeeping of it, they're just trying to hold shit together. It's like, I don't even know if they, of course, everyone can be driven to extremes, but you can see with that, we're in a different time, in a different space. And some of it's like just totally corporate nonsense. Like, oh, we don't want to hurt our image, blah, blah, blah. But also humans by default do not want to hurt each other that badly. It's antithetical to survival. It's antithetical to biological survival. It doesn't make sense. It's like what a crazy animal does, and like when we're turned into crazy animals, we do that. And everyone has a spark of sanity in them, and you see that coming out. Wow, this looks really fucking bad. And he's just like, he knows that, period. What are we doing here? Like, is this what's the point of this anymore? But he was taken aside. He did come back and say, oh yeah, this is, yeah, do it, keep it going, because he knows better. He knows that it's like, it's towing the party line. It's schizophrenic. Like, these people are schizophrenic. It's why it's an interesting political situation. It's somewhere between, you know, corporate slick PR crap and then just this horrible, most obvious violence you could ever imagine, most obvious messages you could ever imagine. So heavy-handed. There's no covering up with any public relations. But yes, that definitely happened. And it gave insight into, like, how they're trying to define themselves and like what is going on there. It's just, they don't even know. They're just trying to relive and recapture that power, empowerment. And it's disturbing.
But okay, so there's two other scenes that like caught, really, really stood out to me. One of them was it seems like they had like Indonesian film crews, right? Like there's like, you can see there's like photographers and, you know, actors and stuff that they are sort of working with, presumably within like an Indonesian film, Indonesian film industry,
mm-hmm.
People, at times. And there's the one guy who says, well, actually, you guys did this to my stepfather and I was 11 years old and you came and you fucking dragged him out of the house and we found his body and we had to, you know, beat up in the street and we had to bury him by the side of the road because no one wanted to help us bury him because they'd be considered communist sympathizers and all this sort of stuff. And he's like, and I'm just saying, and like, he's being like really brave, but really you could tell how frightened he is. He's like, I just wanted to tell you, share this story with you. Because maybe it helps for your movie. And they all look at him you could see the disdain they have for this man of like, fuck you. Like they look at him like he's a piece of shit. Mm-hmm. And it's like, yeah, there's no room for that in our movie. We can't tell your story. This isn't about you. And he's like, no, I'm just saying like these are the, like this is how it went down from our perspective or whatever, like what we went through. And, they're just like looking at him like he's such a pile of shit. So then this idea of like them sort of being guilty or redeemed in any way, you could see on their face that like even the child of the communists, quote unquote, right? Or the Chinese, descendants or things like that, that's still sort of on straight on the surface prejudice was like, you're good enough to help make this, you know, just, you know, follow our instructions here, but don't talk to us. We don't care about what tragedy you went through. This is about our tragedy of having to feel bad about killing people. You know?
So I said that he went through all kinds of trouble to make sure that people weren't reliving traumas, but what this person was actually like Anwar Kongo's neighbor. Like they were friends in theory. This person was clearly successful in society and was like rich enough to live in a neighborhood with one of the biggest thugs in the country. So he was a child of a communist, but he's like, he made enough compromises and flew under the radar enough to get some material success and befriend these people to some sense of the word. But obviously they're not his friends. And the director didn't know about his past. And like, he didn't give the sense of that until that moment when he felt the need to talk about it. Cause it was just like, it was so overwhelming. And cause he was playing, they were reliving like a torture scene in a bamboo hut. It wasn't torture. Yeah. But they were interrogating and like, hitting like his back with a paddle and like these sorts of things, and hitting the table with a paddle and asking him to confess and this sort of shit. And so he's going back into that time. You can tell like he's just shaking and it's not acting. But the director, like he couldn't just stop it. It's at that point is he didn't mean for it to put this person in that situation or whatever, but it ended up being that. And actually he said that he wasn't around when that was being filmed. Either part, like his assists on the crew, like he was off doing something else and they were responsible for that part of it. And he didn't see it until afterwards. And so he wasn't like in a position to even stop it on the situation. So it was like this really unique part of the film where you see that relationship, between like survivors and the perpetrators, that it's this, still this unbelievable, uneasy balance that it's like, as long as you don't talk, we can pretend to be friends. But the moment you do, we're going to tell you to shut the fuck up. And we're going to like look at you like we're going to kill you if you don't stop talking, because that's how they were looking at him. And he got so tense. So that part stuck with me as well, for sure. And the talk show, it was like a Sally Jesse Raphael where they're just talking and just bringing on thugs and murdered people. And this perfectly manicured host like, smiling, her teeth are so white, selling the good news, talking about the good news of the communists are gone, everything's sunny in Indonesia, and the entire crowd is full of paramilitary stooges that they just put in there. They're all wearing the orange junta uniform and applauding like a fucking daytime talk show audience.
Can I ask you, did you get the impression, looking at the actual, the young soldiers, the paramilitary youth group, that was so prominent, they're saying they have like 3 million members and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And they're sort of utilizing those kids. And then their kids is sort of, but you know what I mean?
Of course.
Did you get the impression that any of them gave a shit whatsoever? It wasn't even like I didn't even see in their faces the sort of like, American cop, sort of like, yeah, I love this thing because it brings me power. It seemed more like, I don't even know why the fuck I'm here. I don't really have an option.
Yes.
That's
totally that. And I think they talk about that briefly in the movie or at some point. I think it's like there's a big rally going on. And the rally is the classic guy over the intercom yelling intense shit at the audience, and they're pretending to be into this stupid stage performance with the stupid singers and dancers that are in this like cheap, gaudy Western outfits and sunglasses. And they look, all these people are paid to be there. The thugs go to the neighborhoods. They say, hey, we're having a rally today. Here's a bribe. Show up. So they're either getting money or something. It's all bought and paid for. And the people put on the costume and they go and they stand there and make it look like people still believe in this fiction. And no one believes in any of it. They keep carrying on this charade. And they don't give a shit. And they, like, you can tell, and that's why I think this is, like, inspired a conversation in the country, because you can see the fucking fatigue. And you can see that people are ready for something different than this. So ready. Like, even people that are in being paid and show up, yeah, maybe they're, like, maybe they are just crushed and they don't give a fuck about anything, even the common good. I don't know, but it seems to me that in those sorts of states, people can be open to change, finally. And it's so obvious that story has just burned itself to its conclusion. And no one can take it anymore. I don't know. People here haven't had to deal with that sort of trauma. And the legacy of that trauma. And, like, maybe it would turn us around faster, too. I don't know. The sense is, like, it's just no one cares there about it at all. And it's, like, the people that are involved, yeah, it's, like, mostly just to collect a paycheck, and they're not. They just want to survive. No one wants to hurt each other anymore. I genuinely got that sense of a common good from the people in the film, like, even though it's not there. And from, again, maybe listening to Josh talk about the country and who the people were and what they really wanted. It was them that inspired him to say, hey, they were smart enough to say, hey, expose these people psychologically for what's going on and, like, how everyone is fucking suffering. This has benefited nobody, and it continues to benefit nobody.
And that's the other thing, like, you talk about saying Anwar Kongo being wealthy, but even his level of wealth was pretty meager.
Yeah.
And his, like, sidekick, Herman, he can't even bribe that one election. And Anwar's saying, oh, he doesn't have enough money to do it. He doesn't, you know, he's not rich enough.
Yep.
So you see that where, when they were young and had the sort of, they probably didn't need the money because they just had the power. And now after the democracy came in, now it's money rules, not brute force, you know?
Yeah.
But then you still have on the lower levels, like, it's amazing to me. I mean, you know, classic protection racket bullshit. They have that scene of following the guy as he goes through the marketplace and tells all the shop owners to give him money, otherwise he'll fuck them up. You know, he's like, I need you to give me more than usual this time. And you can see he's like, you know, he's maybe feeling bold because the cameras are on and he wants to be all machismo. So he's like, yeah, actually, you know, you have to give me more this time.
Yeah. Yeah, they're hitting up the old ethnic Chinese guy. I mean, that they're hitting up the ethnic Chinese community because they are prejudiced against them, as the communists are. So even if you're not a communist, in quote, if you're an ethnic Chinese, you're still, like, a lower class citizen, like we talked about earlier. So they go to these storekeeps, and the storekeeps have no fucking protection. Yeah, they have a sham democracy, but no one. It's just, like, these are little isolated islands run by thugs, and thugs do what they want. And no, it's, like, not necessarily the genocide isn't happening, but it's daily intimidation, keeping people afraid that it will. And that's part of the routine, and keeping people afraid. Like, these people are a little afraid and confused that they're even being filmed. What the fuck's going on? But they're like, okay, here's more money. And you can see the last guy's like, he gives him some, and then they're like, no more. He can't even roll his eyes or do anything. It's just, but his body language says it all. He's, like, so defeated. And rightfully so. I mean, that wasn't the hardest part to watch, but for all the grotesque things in the film, you'd think that wouldn't be as bad to watch. If the day-to-day stuff that people are still subjected to, it gives you insight into that. I'm thankful for as shitty as this country is, and as much as we talk about it. It's not good, but I'm just like, I'm lucky. I guess being the Empire and not have to deal with that day-to-day, because it's like I deal with all the nonsense of being in the Empire, and, like, that's its own challenges we all talk about, and not to discount that, but I also realize that I'm, like, very lucky not to have bombs dropped on me every day, and I'm part of the problem, I'm part of that larger enemy, so to speak. I'm glad I wasn't born there. It's fucking rough.
I want to sort of take a little tangent here while we're talking. You mentioned, like, the ethnic Chinese, and so, right, now they have they basically can call anyone they don't like a communist. They even interview at some point. Oh shit! They even interview at some point a guy who runs a newspaper, and has for many years, and says that it was his job. Like, he could just basically run a story about somebody that they didn't like and be like, yeah, this guy, we just make him look bad and then we can kill him.
Mm-hmm.
And, but obviously there was any quote unquote leftist, communist, and ethnic Chinese. And I think the little tangential point I want to make here is just in the last few days, I saw, I don't know why I get these fucking emails. I think I've mentioned this once before, but ThinkBook has a Twitter. I've never used it, but, Doug sometimes throws stuff out on there, but I do get emails from Twitter saying, you know, hey, don't you want to know what's popular in the group of people that we've decided you're sort of affiliated with? And Twitter has consistently decides that I really want to know what Lana from Red Ice is tweeting about. Like, every 2 days I get an email saying, popular in your network, Lana tweeted. And every time I'm like, why is this popular? Like, who am I affiliated with that they like this? That I need to see it because they like it that much.
Yeah.
I really need to get a new network if that's my network. But, just in the last 2 days, she tweets some, you know, Nazi apologist bullshit about there was a real Holocaust that no one wants to talk about. And she's talking about the Holocaust committed by the communists. And giving these like statistics about, you know, how many people the communists killed. And here we are watching a documentary about a genocide of communists, right? And now you could look at that as we're on these sort of polarized angles. I want to sort of make the point here is that I'm not an apologist for anybody. And I think you and I are coming from the same approach here is that, I'm not supporting the killing of communists. I'm not supporting the killing by communists. And I'm not supporting the killing by fascists or fucking anybody. Like, there's not like we get to pick and choose who are the heroes and who are the villains. I think the sort of point of all this is to show that this sort of really atrocious repetition of human lust for power and fucking madness to eradicate the other is all pervasive. It exists all around the globe throughout history. It doesn't matter political affiliation or ethnicity or anything like that. This is something that anyone can relate to because in a way, you know, we're not separate from this. You know, this is, our own psychologies, our own histories, and our own unfortunate, you know, humanness is on display in these actions. And it's up to us to recognize that, not to cherry pick which dictator we want to pat on the back and which one we want to shake a finger at, you know.
Right. And I was just talking to Ben Gurry last night about this. Bill Hicks. I haven't watched much of him in a while, but I chose to watch an interview of him a couple weeks ago. And he brought up, you know, what are we doing? Evolving ideas. I mean, the goal is to like evolve the conversation. And this is like one of those artifacts and things that like evolves conversations and gets people thinking like on this level. The ultimate goal is healing, to like heal the earth, heal the people on it. Not to sing fucking kumbaya, but to like start setting things right and start like living life right again. That's what we just all want. We all, yes, have different definitions of that, but when it comes down to it, it's pretty simple. The human experience is pretty simple. We all want the same things at a base level. And so it's like, yeah, do we want to keep repeating these patterns over and over again? Is this serving us? Like what are we looking at here? And are we looking at ourselves and like what ownership are we going to take of this? Not that we can change it, because I really, you know, I've gone through ups and downs of what should I be contributing to making this all better? how can I make that better? How can I make it so this doesn't happen again? And I cannot do that as an individual. And even the small groups that I'm a part of, like, we don't have that power even as a collective yet. But all we can do collectively is just, like, keep evolving the conversation and hoping that information that'll spread. And not only that, but, like, just living a life that has some integrity to it, where you're not bringing in pain everywhere, not being a fucking pain monster. There's too much of it. There's too much unnecessary amounts of it. The people in this movie, they recognize the pain, but they're just like, we're ready to move on. Let's get this in the open. I fucking forgive you. Let's fucking do something different. No, it won't be easy. Let's go from here. Let's stop repeating the same power games and the same torturing and killing of each other over and over again. That is the game. That is the goal. I don't live up to it so often, but it's just, I want to be, have that integrity and be able to show people, hey, it's like, fucking live your life like a genuine, non-self-deceiving person. Don't be like these self-deceivers that can deceive themselves into murdering another person. God, like taking another life, like that's how far it can go. That's how dangerous we are to each other when we like live that sort of life. And this is just like the most extreme example of that, but it happens every day just to ordinary people in our society in different ways, like different permutations of that same sort of murdering streak, whether, like, you know, it's not murdering someone else, but self-murder is happening all the time. Like, what are you doing to bring like life back to yourself and to the world? Just be a decent example to people around you. You don't have to be fucking famous. You don't have to do anything great. It's always just like, what is around us and like, what can we look at for motivation and inspiration? And if you're not a part of that, you're a part of the problem. And I know I'm often part of the problem, but I also know like what the solution is. It's just getting away from that self-deception and that weaker side of ourselves that just wants to roll over. And again, this film gives insight into that. So much, so deeply, and we are part of this continuum, and we have responsibility to each other. I have responsibility for that story, and I have responsibility as someone that can't save it or help it, per se. I have, like, here we are. This is like we're being responsible, I think, by just talking about it. No, people aren't going to just change tomorrow because they hear about, oh, wow, this, what a horrible story. No, but it could be a starting point to really get deep into, you know, what am I doing? What do I want to do? And do I want to keep being part of the, like something like this? Because this is happening under so many people's noses. Willful ignorance. Even at that time. It's like people knew better. And we know better now. So we just can't say we're ignorant anymore. Even these people in this film who seem, you know, who are quote unquote ignorant, it's like they're not. They speak so eloquently about what they're feeling and doing. That's why I love how Adi's in the movie, because, like, yes, he's a frightening person, but he's also the most honest and gives, like, so much insight into the inner processes. So that's what it means for me. Like, the movie could just be seen as a documentary film or whatever, but it's so much more than that. Maybe you have to be in a certain space, maybe you don't, to watch it, but it all depends what you're trying to get out of it. What you really see in it, because you could come out of it just like you said, you were tired and it was exhausting, and it really is. But I know as someone that's seen, I've seen it like 5 or 6 times, and the value in it for me, it's all that. It's like, that's the value. It just reminds me of those good things.
And just to be clear, like, I wasn't, when I said that, it was more to say like, there came a point where I just, like, where I actually wasn't sure, was I just really, cause like I barely slept yesterday. I had gone to bed pretty late and then I got woken up, with a knock on my door early in the morning. I couldn't fall back asleep. So I'm just saying. So I was pretty fucking tired. I had to wait till the end of the night after I got access to the movie. So like it's probably like 1 a.m. that I started it, and so it was like a 3-hour movie. And normally that's fine for me. I'm up at that time, but I was just exhausted. And like I said, as I'm reaching towards like the last, like, 40 minutes of the movie, I was just like, holy shit, I'm so tired. And my point in saying that was not to say, it was almost like, but I was just like, oh, am I just like this tired, which would actually make sense because I didn't sleep, or is this just like really fucking heavy, You know what I mean? Like, where it's almost like your mind, it's like you notice, there's like a psychological thing of like people yawning when they hear something they don't want to hear. I don't know if you're familiar with that. Like, mm-hmm. little ticks that kind of come through of like cognitive dissonance, trying to kind of like shut down things. So I was questioning myself of like, well, it could just be that I'm tired, but this is also draining. And not in a way that like, man, why'd you make me watch this? But in a way of, wow, this was a really like a really serious rabbit hole and experience, whatever, to go on. You know, it wasn't just like sitting down to watch a movie. It definitely sort of got into your emotional and mental sort of dark places. I didn't feel like in a way that was preachy either. You know, it's not like, like some fucking, what was that? Al Gore thing, you know?
An Inconvenient Truth?
Yeah, you know what I'm saying? It's not like that kind of like documentary where it's like,
not at all.
Well, let me preach to you about whatever my pet project is, you know? And even those, like, I remember, I'm not a giant Michael Moore fan, but I remember, seeing an interview with him after, oh, I think it was Sicko, where someone said, you know, you're not presenting the other side of the argument or something. And Michael Moore said, yeah, I get 2 hours to make my argument. Everyone else, you know, like the pharmaceutical industry has tons of money to put their argument out there. I'm not going to give them half my movie. I have 2 hours to make my point.
Yes.
And I actually, like, I totally respect that. So like that's just to say, like, even in the quote unquote preachy nature of some documentaries, it's understandable as long as you take it with a grain of salt that yes, this is this person's argument, whatever. Anyway, to say it's not like that. It wasn't like, oh man, they're fucking trying to, you know, like they won me over, you know, at the end of the movie, I felt like, well, they're right. It wasn't that kind of movie. It was a very different documentary experience. Like genuinely surreal at throughout the points of, even in some of the production stuff, and just sort of, it was a documentary. I felt like in a really true sense of the word of documenting something. Like, here, mm-hmm. do you want to see what this is? Not like, and then this is what I want you to think about it. I felt like they were really, that was really interesting and I respected that sort of approach because too many documentaries, you know, at the end, it's going to say, what can you do about it? Sign up here, you know, get rid of your light bulbs and sign up here. Just pledge whatever, whatever, you know. I've seen way too many of those documentaries in the last 10 years, so.
Yeah. The only time you hear the director speak is just like he is sometimes, you can hear him in the background talking to some of the people to just guide the conversations, but he's not part of it. I mean, he is and he isn't. He's just like, he's so professional in terms of like making it about everything except him, and to get it so embedded that these people really did, like you said, certain times, especially the guys that aren't on camera all the time, they might like be acting up for the camera, but the characters that were there consistently, Anwar and Herman and even Adi, they're not fucking acting at all. They could care less about the cameras because they've had the attention, that power on them for so long that it's like, that's natural for them, I think. And so it's just, you see like the full honesty, like truth. Men being open about like, oh yeah, I'm still running away from this. It haunts my, Anwar, and he talks about his dreams often throughout the film. And we finally get to see him make one. He's haunted basically by Marilyn Manson.
Yeah. It looked like a Power Rangers bad guy.
Totally. And it starts becoming about his nightmares and not even about the murders. I mean, that is another layer to it. It becomes even deeper as he's exploring a dream within a dream within a dream. And the art, Hermann is always dressing up like a woman.
Yeah.
There's a historical reason for that, in that he used to be in an acting troupe and the acting troupe was male only. And he played in women roles, but I mean, like, he likes it, and he liked it. He continues to like it. His anima is on, like, full display. This, like, psychotic anima, who, during one of the scenes, eats the human liver, or whatever it is. Whatever piece of meat he bites into, it's disgusting. to give people more of a sense of where that goes, but that, and why it's so surreal. This man in drag covered in like fake blood with his friend who's pretending to be a severed head. And just like, what am I watching? But it's never so absurd that it doesn't sink in, like, because you know what you're seeing. You're seeing madness and sadness at a deep level. And just keeps me inspired to just God. That, like, I can make all sorts of compromises. They made the darkest compromises, but I don't want myself to be that. You know, not to that extreme, obviously, but we have our own permutations of those monsters in our society, and we can become those. We have it programmed inside of us. The journey and the fight is to not do that, not give in to the deceit. So many of those men were deceived into becoming murderers. Maybe not deceived, but I don't know if that's part of it, though. I mean, the propaganda machine is powerful, sophisticated, and humans are so susceptible and vulnerable. Just can't help but feel bad for everybody involved with that. But like I mentioned, it's not like nothing has come out of it. It was just like, oh, look at this porn from the third world about like how bad people's lives are so we can feel better about ourselves or something. It's like, it's a real human struggle story, and it's like inspiring that people can still like even dream big under those conditions. And he made a sequel to this called The Look of Silence, which still builds off this theme where he's meeting with perpetrators and filming them, but they're one-on-one interviews. And what he did was he brought his closest confidant in the country, who he started working with, whose brother was killed during the genocide and still lived with it and was trying to like...
So you cut out there. You said the brother that lived what?
During the military takeover and was targeted and killed. And so this guy is a survivor, and his parent, he's his only parent's son that's left. And
gotcha.
And so they stay very focused on that little family and this person. And he goes and confronts the local mayor. They get into these interviews with all these like major players from the time, and he lets this survivor interview them and ask really dangerous questions. Like, he asks them extremely dangerous questions, and he even exposes himself halfway through the interviews when he's finally, like, has his teeth into it and feels like, okay, I have space to say it, and this guy's not going to pull a gun on me or something. And it was this delicate process of him easing into the conversations and finding out more about them and, like, saying, like, it was really, hey, I'm a survivor. I want to move on. I want to move on, and like, you are my neighbor, and like, you are in power, and how do you feel about how you got power, and like, is this good for us as a people and a country? I mean, these are the things he gets into with them. He's basically like, you killed people to get your power, and the guy responds, that's politics. Dude, the communists want it to happen again, you know? It's like that, and then he wants the conversation to go away. But somehow they manage to pull these conversations off beyond just the little intermittent stories of these people's lives. It's littered with these amazing dialogues one-on-one. And again, pushing the boundaries of human dialogue, because it's dangerous. It was really dangerous for them. But it produced a similar thing. It was less of a general story and more of like focused on this one guy and what it means for the people in there and like what they're striving for. They're trying to overcome that badly, and they're willing to go so deep for it. I don't see that in America, I guess. So that's why it like inspires me. It's like, I know that exists in humanity to want to overcome so badly and to like get on the right track again. And we know, it's just like in our inner compass, we know what the right way is. It's fucking peace. It's fucking all the hippie shit. It's love, blah, blah, blah. But it's so important.
Well, I mean, you know, you can see different iterations of the same cycles. Like, I thought it was interesting. There's a scene where Anwar says, So I guess the history is that there was a point where communism wasn't illegal. He says, you know, in the 60s, it wasn't illegal, but then after their little coup, it was. And now then there was the coup. Those guys were in power for a while. They're still essentially in power, but, then a democracy was installed, and they're saying, well, you know, this democracy's kind of bullshit. You know, I liked it better when we were just a dictatorship, all this sort of stuff. But anyway, there's a point where Anwar says something about politicians, and he says, you know, well, they're just robbers in ties, right? And it's sort of like, it's a really astute observation, but then it reminds me of like the end of Clockwork Orange, where you have the sociopathic, like, murderer, the guy who actually will stab and rape and kill people, and then you have the politician who comes and says, hey, we should work together, you know, like,
yes,
it's recognizing that they're both doing the same thing, but in different styles, you know?
Yep.
And so in that, I feel like our style is sort of, at least on the surface, has enough of a sheen that it's a little harder for people to get behind questioning it.
Mm-hmm.
But you do see little iterations. So just to say, like, so nothing's really changed for them. It's still the thugs in control, but they're in control through bribery and elections and whatever. But there's always that sort of physical intimidation is present, right? Like,
yeah.
Don't forget that we can do this stuff again.
Yeah.
Here in the United States, I feel like there is that too. And particularly in this sort of slippery, I don't know why I'm sugarcoating to say a slippery slope. I mean, like, you know, I guess in juxtaposition with, say, the documentary that I watched last night, The Act of Killing, yeah, I mean, there aren't, even if we have police, you know, shooting random people and beating people up and political intimidation, so far at least they are not going in and, like, raping and burning entire towns or anything.
Right.
You know, I guess the only reason I'm sort of like, I'm hedging back is to say, well, we're not there, obviously, but, without a doubt, and we're in that different sort of style of how we oppress. You know, we have the business hostile takeover. We don't go in with machetes. You know, we go in with lawyers or, you know, all these sorts of things that we do. And again, with, you know, just the reminder of the physical violence seems to be sufficient. But I guess I'm asking, does that veneer, the sort of polished oppression, make it harder to talk about and fight against?
Yeah, I mean, that's why it's so insidious, I guess. I mean, that's why it's always equated to the pan of water getting boiled, you know, getting boiled to death slowly. If people don't sense that it's changing drastically, they can just keep getting dragged along with the program. Yeah, so it's like, I feel like less of, that's why I was saying I'm a little more cynical about the West, or like what the first and second world West, of people snapping out of it, because we don't have that sort of rage. I mean, there has to be a rage there, and Americans are full of rage, but we've been taught to turn it back on ourselves or to totally externalize it, like not strike a proper balance. And nothing to, like, inspire us to, like, truly say, oh, it's, like, it's not obvious. It's not blunt enough. And that's why people are scared of where the world's going, in a sense, because it's, like, well, people need to be pushed to breaking points, but if you can keep them at a slow burn, is there a way that that might not happen, where they might not snap? And this is, like, where I think of, like, the magic of, like, Gurdjieff and Leary and Robert Anton Wilson, they talk about, and Tara Ali, they talk about shock, you know, like shock therapy. In the West, it's sort of like that's where we kind of need it a bit. We still get that. I mean, but like Snowden, right? That should have been a shock therapy and so on. So that's not even the answer totally either. But yes, it's not like obvious enough. And if it is, speaking with Ben last night, we said, you know, it doesn't seem like people aren't aware necessarily. It's just like, where's the courage? Where's the courage that I see, like, a guy's willing to confront a fucking person that murdered his brother and talk and say, you murdered my brother. That's really fucking, that was a shit thing to do. Now, can we forgive each other and move on, please? Because you live right next door to me. It's like, do we have that courage?
I would harbor a bloodlust. You know, I would want revenge.
that's the heart of my week. I have that bloodlust when someone wrongs me. It's like, it's hard for me to let petty stuff go. It's hard for me, you know, it's like, it's ridiculous. It's like I manifest
right,
that
so this
thing.
Right, so this is not a petty thing. This is a big thing. And the fact that people are able to, you know, sort of rise above. If you and I, you know, have a hard time getting over our small grudges, how do you get over something that big, you know?
Yeah. And that's, yeah. So I'm still totally optimistic that it's like people can. And it's like, that's an example of people are working towards that at certain parts of the world. And I think we're trying to spark that here. At least I feel part of that continuum of trying to bring that about everywhere and evolve that conversation, like have that conversation. And also like be given space to live lives that are meaningful to us personally. And like, where it's not, we're not living with fear and guilt and doubt all the time. That's the fucking goal. And people need that freedom and space. And like, fear is a crippling thing in all its forms, whether it's imaginary or real. Whatever we imagine can make happen in a lot of ways. And so if we choose it, that's our reality. And it's incumbent on us to choose the good side. Again, I don't want to think too much in black and white, but there is some good and bad in the world. And it's just, it's good to be loving and peaceful and understanding that you both are you're an individual person, but you need other people. Like, it's not one or the other. It's pretty simple. It's like, what are you doing? What are you doing each day to remind yourself of that? And as bleak as this film is, it helps me do that. It has all the themes of death and rebirth, of course. And that's a thing too, but it reminds me of human strength as much as it reminds me of human weakness. I can't believe I've seen it as many times. It's ridiculous. And I'm so happy that you're willing to talk about it, because I like made my roommate watch it once and he really liked it. He liked it. And he did offer me good feedback on it. And he was someone that engaged me on it, but I don't want to force it on people. And it's good. It's nice to have a conversation about it, because it's been meaningful to me, whether people get something out of this or not, or they, whatever. It's like, who wants to hear about someone talking about a movie they haven't seen, or listen to a conversation about a movie they haven't seen for an hour. But I hope like we've made it clear enough, like why it's just like what is powerful about it and why it's like inspiring a conversation in the first place. So.
Oh yeah. I think it's a conversation worth having. And you know me, I don't want to talk about politics as in like election stuff. But I mean, I do feel like to a certain extent, this election cycle sort of shows you, you know, in the same sort of way of how in, Active Killing is sort of going through these reenactments sort of exposes things for how they really are. I feel like watching America sort of shuffle through the sham that is this election sort of puts the ugly underbelly on full display, whether they realize it or not, you know?
Yeah, it can be like a powerful mega ritual in the same way. But it's like also how people respond to it, because it's like everyone sees it and talks about that, but what are we doing about it? Like personally, this is why I'm just like, I choose not to vote. I don't know if that's good or bad. I've just decided that's good for me, and I'm not going to encourage anyone to do it or not to do it. It's up to you, whatever that means to you to cast a ballot. It's just symbolic for me not to. I can't bring down the system, but I can definitely flick it off. No. you pick the stooge. And it's like, when enough people are ready to turn their back on it and take ownership of their own shit, instead of hoping that Trump or Hillary is going to deliver the promised land to them, it's like, our communities need fucking help. If you want to really participate, that's where you should start, and your attention should not be on the federal level. My attention isn't on many levels. Like, I'm still a timid person, but I know that when I do focus, it's usually about what's right around me. And like, that's where my attention should go when I'm ready to do that again, when I'm ready to be like actively politically. Federal is too fucking big and it's too crooked. We're moving towards an era where I really think humanity is moving in like sort of a confederacy model of existing. What we know is America, it's just gonna, like, it's not gonna exist like this forever, and it's gonna break up into loosely affiliated confederacies. And so the truth is, what are we doing to lay the groundwork for the future? And sometimes that's psychological, sometimes that's material. We all have different skill sets to offer to like building the future, and that's what we should be doing. It's like, we put ideas out there, other people like fucking build houses. I can't build a house, can maybe help you build a house inside yourself, but that's like it. And I don't know what else to say about it.
About you building houses?
The house of the self.
You know, oh, it's a metaphor.
It's a fucking metaphor, because I'm deep like that, and I'm full of all kinds of sensitive shit.
How long would it take you to rebuild your temple?
I haven't figured that out. I don't think that the temples will never be rebuilt. Philip K. Dick already taught me this. It was burned down and time stopped. We're in it. I don't know how long. Infinity? It's going to take a while.
So we're trapped in that 3 days? Jesus is like, I could rebuild that shit in 3 days. And they're like, oh yeah? Well, we're going to trap you in a time bubble 2 days in.
Inside that iron prison. Good luck, sir. But it's like that idea of the iron prison. That's so obvious. And it's just so obvious. It's so beautifully simple. And like, we talk about it a lot, but we talk about it maybe like just too symbolic. It's like, oh man, it's like the Matrix in reality. But it's like, it's also, this is what it means to exist in it and live it day to day. So that's important, to live in the world and awake, but also like at peace. How is that done? And I think it's much easier than we think it is, but it's also impossibly hard knowing too much, whatever that means. But yeah, catharsis, just talking, but sometimes not talking at all, just doing. It's also a good choice. And I know like these conversations, yeah, we're talking, but for me, a lot of time it's just like doing too. I'm like doing something that, yeah, I'm giving and putting something out that's building. It's not destroying. Even if it's like trivial or whatever, like it doesn't really reach a lot of people, at least I'm trying to be constructive. It's just a generic sort of energy. If we think in terms of like thermodynamics, there's way more efficient ways to use our energy. So many more efficient ways. And you can work as like a fucking antiquated piston engine, combustion engine, or you can like move into like the future of what it means to like burn your fuel cleanly ad infinitum, be a cold fusion reactor, be a superconductor, whatever. This is why science has so many awesome analogies. It's too bad that it's so compartmentalized from the emotional side of life for people, because when you like realize the power of those analogies, it makes the goals pretty simple. It's like, I'm trying to mimic nature and to be what the best that nature has to offer, because that's what we are.
You're trying to build a clean energy device that works, that creates power by burning off psychological dross.
I think it can be done. And I think that is like what all occultism is built around. It's like to make yourself that sort of machine. I mean, that is the Gurdjieff philosophy. That's the Gurdjieff model for sure. You're turning yourself into a fine tune, whatever. I like instrument, like tuning yourself as an instrument and getting yourself into the point where the notes you make are ringing at the right pitch and like working together and so on. Or you can be in completely out of tune and even acknowledging it and not even trying to retune yourself. So, there's more we could do, but also, whatever. It's just, there's a time to just not feel so bad about it. What more could I be doing? Just what are you doing? What are you doing well? And I think we do this pretty fucking well. And I'm happy to be talking and having this conversation.
Thank you for listening to this broadcast from SyncBook Radio. If you enjoyed this episode, there's so much more content waiting for you at thesyncbook.com. Our newest episodes are always free, and members get access to our full archive of over 600 hours. You'll find all of this, as well as our books and videos, at thesyncbook.com.